Coming up on this week's episode of TechSnap, in Barnes & Noble's attempt to censor a hacking article, they've propelled it into the spotlight. We've got the details of this great write-up, plus moving files around the world, speeding up torrent downloads, and Microsoft's big Hotmail flop. All that and more on this week's episode of TechSnap. Hi everyone, and welcome to TechSnap. This is Jupiter Broadcasting's weekly systems network and administration podcast. This is episode 56, and we stream this one live on May 3rd, 2012. This episode is brought to you by GoDaddy.com, and I'll tell you more about them as the show goes on. And the live stream is powered by ScaleEngine.com, which is awesome. My name is Chris, and joining us every single week is our host, the admin, the tech, and the teacher, Alan Jude. Hey there, Alan.
Hey, Chris, everybody. Thanks for watching.
Oh, boy, do we have a great show today. So we've got some interesting news we're going to cover right at the very beginning of the show. Then in the feedback section, we're going to tell everybody about the CDN situation, sort of the conclusion to that story that we talked about last week. You've got a little trick you're going to show for how you mount smaller SSD drives in hot swappable server drive bays.
Yes, random problems that crop up when you're building servers.
You've been building servers like a madman lately, so that's totally where your head's at, so that'll be interesting. Plus, we've got a great roundup coming up, so tons of stuff. Before we jump into the news, because my wife reminded me, and I think this might have been a hint, Alan, and I'm not sure, but she wanted me to make sure I remind everyone out there that Mother's Day is coming up, and when you shop over at Amazon, think of Jupiter Broadcasting. If you go to the jupiterbroadcasting.com site and scroll all the way down to the very bottom of our website, you'll find links down there for Amazon, US, UK, Newegg, Think Geek, Best Buy, Mint.com, Audible.com, and the new Gamefly. But I don't really think Gamefly is going to rock mom's world. Maybe, I don't know. Audible might. I could see Audible.
My mom's Mother's Day present comes from Think Geek.
Think Geek. Definitely Think Geek's in there. I also could totally see Amazon, right? So if you want to help us while you're getting your mom something, plus you can say, Mom, I watch all of this great independent entertainment online, and they were helped out when I got your gift. So, Mom, you helped them too. Happy Mother's Day. And then she'll bake you a pie because that's such a great story, and she'd really appreciate that.
And I like pie.
Everybody likes pie, so everybody wins. Exactly. All right, Alan. Well, we've got a story at the top of the show that's a follow-up on the OpenSSL vulnerability we talked about not too long ago. So what is going on?
Last week, I think, wasn't it?
I wasn't sure if it was last week or the week before.
It was live last week, I think.
Okay. So what is the latest?
Anyway. So most of the distributions actually have their fixes out now so that you can actually patch up. You know, OpenSSL released their fix right away, but, you know, it takes a little longer for the actual distros to integrate that and put it into their package system and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I got the email this morning from FreeBSD saying, you know, update your SSL because their fix for it actually covers five different vulnerabilities that have been
Okay.
So I have a list of the vulnerabilities and links to them and everything. Okay. There's quite a bit, actually.
Yeah, this is pretty significant, huh?
Yeah, with, you know, one that was a double free in the policy check, so it would actually free the memory twice, causing memory to be unset when it wasn't meant to be.
you know, you weren't using that memory, were you?
SSL 3.0 padding. That one was particularly bad, and that's the main fix for this version. And basically what happened there is, when SSL sends a message, for some of the different encryption algorithms, the message has to be exactly a whole number of block sizes.
Yeah, okay.
So if the message is a little bit shorter than that, what they do is they pad the message, add a little bit of stuff to the end to make it exactly so many blocks.
Okay.
But there was a bug in OpenSSL where when it was doing that, it would use memory that hadn't been properly zeroed out first.
Oh.
So it could basically cause up to 15 bytes of memory from your computer to be sent encrypted to the other person.
And would there be a way to exploit that so you could get maybe specific information from memory?
Probably not specific, but if you did it enough, you might recover large chunks of memory.
Oh, true, because you could do it over and over and over and over and over and over again, couldn't you?
Especially if, you know, if you're running an SSL web server or something, then that means the peer could basically keep getting 15 bytes at a time.
Right.
And eventually read a good chunk of your memory, maybe.
Yeah.
And you know, if that chunk of the memory happens to include, you know, your shadow file off a Linux box or your master password off a BSD box or whatever, then, you know, John the Ripper and there's your password.
Right. And it's good for just any kind of reconnaissance you could do. And that's an interesting vulnerability and such a scary one, because it,
and you know, it's encrypted, so only the person that's communicating with you would see it. But
yeah, okay.
You know, because they can just keep starting new sessions or whatever and keep talking to you over and over and over until they built up a lot of these 15 byte blocks, they might actually get something.
Huh. So there you go. So everybody now go fire up your patchers, because the patches have officially arrived.
And it has one for a denial of service attack where you could basically do the server gated cryptography and keep causing it to restart and basically use up all the resources.
Uh-huh.
There's one for the S/MIME handling for encrypted emails and so on. And then the ASN1 BIO vulnerability, which was the one we covered last week or the week before. For that. Also, don't confuse OpenSSL with OpenSSH. They're not the same thing.
Right. Right.
OpenSSH just came with version 6 as well.
There you go. Okay.
Yep.
Anything else?
No, that's about it.
All right, everyone. So there you go. So
just a heads up.
A little follow-up to that one. Now, this next story might be getting Barnes & Noble in a little bit of controversy, I would say.
A little bit. The coverage that I have here is mostly more about what the article was about and how cool it is.
Well, yeah, I mean, it just ends up, the end result is getting the article more publicity. But I guess Barnes & Noble pulled this, the Linux Format magazine, which I love Linux Format, off of their shelves.
I've never heard of it before. But.
Oh, really? Well, it's a UK magazine, so.
Right.
But
apparently it's sold in the US as well, because it was US Barnes & Nobles that were pulling it off the shelf.
Yeah, it's expensive, but it's a good one. And it was pulled off of Barnes & Noble's shelves. Oh, what happened? What happened?
Okay, so issue 154... The front cover, the main article that they're, you know, trying to get you to buy the magazine for, in some big letters on the front cover of the magazine, it's like, learn to hack.
Right.
Now, the image you have up there is their post from, their post about it getting taken down, so that censored thing isn't actually on the front cover
of
the magazine.
Right, well, that was added because it had been censored, right.
Yes. But basically, apparently, Barnes & Noble got a bunch of complaints about the magazine and decided to stop selling it. It's kind of...
You gotta be kidding me.
The people who complained obviously didn't know what it was and thought, oh, you shouldn't be teaching people how to hack. It's like, you know, if it's something you can learn from a magazine, it, you know, the system that you're hacking isn't that secure.
Right, right. And to be honest, this is like, there's excerpts of the article out there and huge portions of it were dedicated to actually using these tools to protect yourself.
Well, TuxRadar.com actually has pretty much the whole article up there.
Yeah.
And I've kind of walked through some of the things it does. But yes, everything in here is basic knowledge that lets you understand what some of the stuff we talk about is, like how a system actually gets hacked into.
Right. Well, and these tools are legitimate tools for doing this. Yeah. But there's,
you know, they have the giant disclaimer at the top that don't be doing, you know, this to other people's computers because it's illegal and so on.
But I mean, let's be honest. These tools are designed specifically for this intention, and whether they talk about it or not, these tools still exist.
Yeah.
And you might as well teach people to empower themselves, since there are other people who will be getting information from other sources besides magazines and will know how to use these.
Right. So basically, the article walks the user through using Backtrack Linux, which we've talked about before.
Yep.
Which is a penetration testing distribution, right? It's basically designed to help you scan systems and find problems with them. And then basically what the article does is walk you through using Backtrack to exploit a virtual machine you're running on your computer. Specifically, they're using Metasploitable, which is a VMware virtual machine image that the people that make Metasploit made, that has a bunch of vulnerabilities purposely left open on it.
Oh, nice.
And it's for you to basically practice breaking into it.
Oh, that's cool.
Seeing the different ways you might break into a system like that.
That's a really great idea.
Yeah. So the tutorial walks you through... also, it kind of walks you through this idea of island hopping we've kind of talked about. Now, it's just one machine, so it's not really island hopping. It's more escalation, but still. So the tutorial starts by allowing you to exploit a PHP vulnerability in TikiWiki, which is one of the open source wiki programs.
Yep.
And so you use the PHP vulnerability and basically get to run a shell as the user www-data, right? Which is a user that's specifically locked down so that when there's a vulnerability with your PHP script, they're kind of...
It's the user the Apache server runs as.
Right. But then it escalates that by looking at the authorized keys file, which normally doesn't need to be secured because it's just a list of the public half of the keys that are allowed to log in as root.
Right, yeah.
Now, in this case, the version of Ubuntu that they're using is one of the older ones that has the Debian SSH key weakness.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. So basically, by looking at the keys that are in the authorized keys file, because of the Debian vulnerability, which resulted in only 37,000 possible keys, by looking at the hash or the short fingerprint of the public key that's allowed to log in, you can then, there's a .tar file you can download of all 37,000 possible Debian keys.
Of course there is.
So you just find the right one, grip through that chunk, and basically you find the private key that will allow you to log in as root on that machine.
That's a nice one.
And that exploit would basically work on any Ubuntu machine in like 8 or 9 that hadn't been patched.
Patch your S, people.
Yeah. So then the tutorial moves on from attacking a server, right, where, you know, they have to be running a web server or something for you to break into, to what you would do to a desktop machine.
Okay, that's interesting.
Right? So a desktop machine, it's more likely that the desktop you're trying to break into is local, right? It's just a physical machine. So if you have physical access to a machine, it's fairly trivial to boot it off a live CD or a live USB, mount the hard drive, and start reading all the files. However, Ubuntu has started having this option where you can encrypt your home directory.
Right. Yeah.
So people can't do that. So then the tutorial walks you through how you would be more devious and actually still manage to get those files.
Okay.
So you use the live CD to mount the hard drive from this machine you're trying to get the files off of.
Okay.
And then you install your own little Trojan, a little reverse TCP shell. So you basically come up with a little process called Ubuntu Updater, or whatever you want to name it deceptively, so that when people see it running, they think it's supposed to be there.
Right.
You set that up, and that basically creates a tunnel back to your machine that's always open.
Beautiful.
Allows you to connect and run commands on the server.
And this is an example of something that if you have the right Metasploit framework for, it will actually do against a machine that's vulnerable for you automatically. It'll actually send data and execute it.
That's how the PHP one happens, right? You use Metasploit and basically make it run commands for you to get that SSH public key so you can find the matching private key and go ahead and do that. So basically, you set up a little app running on their computer. You add it to rc.local so it starts up as when they boot up every time. And it basically tunnels back to your machine and leaves an open back door for you.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, is how you hack a Linux box right there.
Right. So then when the user logs in and it mounts their home directory and decrypts it, or mounts it so that the user can access their own files, your back door running on their machine can also access their files.
Yeah.
And now you can access that encrypted home directory.
Right, because now you're running in the same user space that they are, which is decrypted the files. And
Yeah. And then, you know, we also have other things like they talk about how using John the Ripper to crack passwords.
Right.
If you have physical access to a machine with, for example, that live CD, one of the most popular ways or the easiest way to undetectably break into a machine you have physical access to is, you know, with that live CD, you can walk up to it, and you can mount the drive, and you could overwrite the root password's hash,
right?
With the hash of a known password,
right?
So you just change the password to something else, right? By default in Linux, you can do this in single user mode, right? If you just boot the machine in single user mode, it doesn't prompt for a root password when you boot up, and you can just change the root password,
right?
Right. That's how you normally recover a lost root password,
right?
Now there are some settings you can put in your initrc or comparable file to make it require a password, right? Consider the local terminal insecure so that that can't happen. But if they mount your ext234 whatever file system from a live CD, they can again overwrite the your shadow file and put in their own password. However, that's detectable, right? If I sit down on my machine and my root password doesn't work, I know somebody's been tampering with
it. That's usually a good indicator.
But if I come up with my live CD and take a copy of your password file and leave. And, you know, I can take it home and run it on John the Ripper on all my spare machines or a bunch of machines I've hacked into, right? If I'm using Metasploit and I take over a whole bunch of web servers, I could divide the John the Ripper workload between a bunch.
Right.
Anyway, keep working on it and try to crack your password. Once I know your password, I can come back to your machine, log into it with your root password and start doing things again without you noticing.
Right. Yeah.
And then it walks through some things like using Wireshark to capture unencrypted HTTP traffic.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's why most sites use SSL when you try to log in, because otherwise anybody listening on your network segment in Wireshark can see your password going back and forth.
Wireshark is an awesome tool for troubleshooting as well.
Yes, it is. Very important for troubleshooting.
It's a great tool all around. Along the same lines, so is TCP dump.
Yeah.
For troubleshooting.
Wireshark is basically just a GUI on TCP dump.
Yeah.
And it's very useful. And it's cross-platform and it's open source. So what more could you ask for?
Nothing.
So anyway, I have links to Metasploit's article on setting up your own test lab and their VMware image that this article talks about.
I love the idea of that VMware image. I love that
basically
idea.
Basically, it's a machine specifically set up to be exploited. Like, I remember when I took my Microsoft security class in college, they had a virtual machine set up that we would be breaking into. We used the Microsoft proprietary bitmap format. It's like WBMP or whatever. We used an exploit for that, where basically you'd send somebody this image and they would look at it. You send someone to a web page and it would have this image embedded, and their browser would open it automatically because, you know, that's what browsers do with images.
Loading an image, yeah.
And it would fire off the buffer overflow and make it start calculator on their machine.
Nefarious.
Yeah. You could, you know, proved it worked, right? But you could make it start some other program.
Oh, yeah. Like, oh, absolutely.
Something else.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Not even it. So, geez, just wait till that's getting in your porn, people. Just wait. Alan, I don't know if it was this show. We had an email that came in to one of the shows recently, asked how different ways passwords to Hotmail accounts could be lost because somebody thought their account had been hacked. And now you've got a story here in the TechSnap
lineup.
Also,
we talked about, I think it was last week or the week before, the Microsoft had a blogging promotion going on, and they were trying to get people to switch back to Hotmail.
Right.
And then the guy had his Hotmail account hacked.
That's right. That's right. Hey, oh, yeah, we had a... Oh, yeah, that's right. We had... So do you think these are related? What's the story here?
So Microsoft has patched a zero-day flaw in Hotmail that basically let anybody reset somebody else's password. So normally when you go reset your password, you know, they ask you secret questions, and they also... if you have another email associated with it, they will email you a token and so on. But basically, the way that their system worked was basically you needed that token in order to reset the password. And once you had that token, it would allow you to set a new password. But the way their code worked, there was an issue where it wasn't properly checking the token. It would check if the token was there, but if just some token was there, it would allow you to overwrite some of the user's password.
Wow. That's a good one. I mean,
it makes you wonder how somebody found that, because that's so trivial, you wouldn't even think of looking there.
Yeah, unless you almost had some sort of guesswork as to how they would do it or something.
Or if you reset your Hotmail password and you were like copying the link from your email and you truncated it and it still worked and you were like, how'd that happen?
Yeah. Yeah. So this was found by a site called Vulnerability Lab, huh? What do we know about them?
Not very much. I didn't.
They have like the most plain report ever. It's just literally text.
Almost all of these vulnerability reports are text like that, right?
Like, I kind
of
like it.
The OpenSSL ones and the full disclosure list when we were talking about the RuggedCom stuff. Again, that was all plain text.
I kind of like it.
It's just how the community works. It ensures everybody can read it.
There's
nothing
I get,
more
Alan.
Open source than ASCII.
I like it. But seriously, the more we do all our show notes in as much text as we can get. We use the Markdown format because
So it's just plain text with a little bit of formatting.
Yeah, and
just some special characters to indicate things.
That's worked well for us.
Yes, it makes writing it so much faster.
Yeah, and then it makes it so you have a good idea of what it'll look like once it gets posted up on the website too, which is nice. All right, Alan, any other thoughts on that story?
So anyway, the apparently they found the vulnerability around April 6th.
And oh, okay.
Discussion back and forth. They notified Microsoft on April 20th, and Microsoft responded and had it fixed within a few hours. But, you know, by then it had already been exploited pretty badly, and a lot of accounts were...
Wow. Apparently. But really, though, a few hours,
when
that's
people
pretty...
first found out about it, they were, you know, people were... that knew about it, and when other people didn't, were trying to say, you know, I can reset any Hotmail password for $20 or whatever. But then, you know, the word gets around and people post a YouTube video on how to do it.
Well, and I think Crash in the chat room brings up an important point. He says that, you know, Microsoft is tying this same login into Windows 8 in the future.
Right, like that's what we talked about with the article last week.
Right.
Is this guy had his Hotmail account attacked, but that's the same login for his entire live infrastructure.
So that's and if he's a Microsoft technet, if he uses any of that stuff.
His Windows 8 desktop login, his Metro store login, his Xbox login, which has his credit card, and so on and so on.
And the thing about the TechNet logins is you only get so many activations with downloads. So if somebody logged in and downloaded all your stuff and activated on you, you're boned. I mean, this has got to become like, you're right. They got to go the direction of some sort of token system, or it's got to become just ironclad.
Right. And but basically, they were not checking the token. They were checking that there was a token, but your token could have been high there, rather than the random big string that it's supposed to be.
Right, right, absolutely. All right, well, any other thoughts on that guy?
The last one was just that if your account was stolen in this way, it can be awfully difficult to recover it.
See.
Because if the attacker changes the questions and answers for your secret questions, then you can't validate your identity to actually reset your password again.
Right.
And so, you know, if you're stealing an account, that's the first thing you do after you get the password or reset it, is you change the secret questions and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is why we've talked about, you don't want to use the same password on a bunch of services, and especially your email, right? Because we talked about if somebody gets in your email, then they can trigger a password reset on all your other accounts. And once they do that, they can log into all those accounts and change the secret questions.
Absolutely. You know me, I'm always for good password hygiene.
Yeah.
All right, Alan. Well, I want to tell everybody about something else that's ironclad, and that's GoDaddy.com. And everybody knows GoDaddy.com has great deals, but we have a fan-freaking-tastic deal for the month of May. You guys have used this deal because I don't know if we're ever going to see anything this good again. Use the code. It's nuts.
Bigger than I was expecting.
I know. It's great. It's great. Use the code 25MAY7, and that will save you 25% off your entire order when you're shopping at GoDaddy.com. And I want to tell you something about GoDaddy.com. Is I want you to think about it in the terms of saving yourself time. I'll give you an example. I am tonight on the JBLive.tv live stream around 6 p.m. Pacific going to record the first test episode of our new show, Unfiltered. And there is a lot of work into building something new, a project like this, and getting it off the ground. And one of the things that I wanted was a blog that was sort of a companion to the show to cover a lot of the things we'd be talking about. And so I built filterfree.me. Mm-hmm. The key thing, though, was in the midst of all of this getting ready for a show, I don't have like a ton of time to deploy a Linux box, throw WordPress on there, install all the updates. So all I did is I went over to one of my existing super cheap GoDaddy shared hosting boxes. I went into their hosting connection area, and they have tons of different things from Joomla to WordPress to Drupal. Shopping carts, e-commerce things. You type them in here, you hit search, and you install them on your hosting server almost like you do an app on a mobile device. And then once you do that, they also allow you to manage the security updates for those. So I can see I have three different WordPress installations right here. And I can see that I need to update to 3.3.1 across all three of them. And I can actually execute that right now just by hitting update right there. And it will send the update out to that server. When it's done, it comes back and says your update is completed. I mean, it's a really great service. And once I already had the shared host, which, again, is super fast to set up, it was click, click, click. 15 minutes later, I had another subdomain assigned to that virtual host, and I had a WordPress blog, and I'm ready to go, and it's awesome. So GoDaddy saves a ton of time when you need to deploy something really quick like that. And if you use our code 25MAY7 when you check out, you'll save 25% off your entire order. That's a fantastic deal. There's more deals in the TechSnap show notes.
Seriously, that deal's so good, I'm redoing a whole whack of my domains, even ones that aren't up up for renewal anytime soon.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm never going to get it cheaper than that.
Yeah, I have domains that I think I'm definitely going to jump on that. I was even kind of on the fence, but with a deal like that, I'm going for it. So thank you to GoDaddy
for supporting Plus, if you buy a bunch, you get another discount on top of it.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. And so thank you to GoDaddy for supporting TechSnap. Sure. And thank you to everyone who uses those codes and supports this show by supporting our advertisers. All right, Alan, what do you say? It's feedback time, yeah?
Yep.
All right, let's do it. It's time for the TechSnap feedback. And welcome to the TechSnap feedback. This week, we're answering some of your questions related to download troubles we've had over on the Jupiter Broadcasting websites with some of our video files. And some of you have probably wondered, how do you mount these SSD drives that are smaller than a standard hard drive into a standard hard drive rack tray for hot swapping? So we'll answer that too. But why don't we start with the CDN? So to quickly recap for those who didn't see last week's episode, we were using blip.tv to distribute the HD and mobile and large video downloads that you could download directly on each show's post. I guess Alan's getting up for some reason. But Blip TV had a pretty big change in how their infrastructure works, and that made it so we could no longer use them for hosting. So, like, literally, we went with one day having file hosting for our videos to the next day, we didn't have a solution for what to do with our videos. And I tried, you know, I was doing stopgap measures, like just dumping files on Libsyn and maxing out Libsyn accounts. I threw them up on Rackspace to try to, you know, because I knew that at least there to be somewhere where people could get them quickly, but that's super expensive. Actually charge for blood per gigabyte. I didn't realize that, so now I'm taking supplements to produce more blood. It's so it was a hectic week last week. It was hectic. I looked at all of the different options out there. Really, I mean, there's a lot of different CDN services, but Jupiter Broadcasting needs something kind of unique because we have large video files and we have people all over the world downloading them. And the way our downloads work is peak release, and then there's sort of this curve off, and then it kind of just evens out for about a month, and then it sort of tails down. And then there's just this slow little bit of trickle. But that first, like, two or three release day window is very active. And so if you host the files, like, on a single web server, you just bring that web server to its knees, and it's not able to respond to the demand.
And everyone gets, you know, a rather slow download in that case, too.
Yeah, and of course, if you're in Ireland and you're downloading from a server in Texas, you're not getting...
You know, even Los Angeles, which would be even further away, right?
Right. So... We were left in a position of having to scramble, but Alan, of course, everyone is familiar with ScaleEng, and that's Alan's company that does the live stream hosting, also where Jupiter Broadcasting's website runs. But we hadn't moved over our content files yet because the Blip TV deal was so sweet. It was basically a $10 a month for a flat rate, which is, like, insane. I mean, that's essentially totally
basically
free.
Impossible, and that's why it didn't
end. Well, that was,
it was great while it lasted. But.
Yeah, I mean, and I knew it was because I'd actually been talking to Alan about this problem on and off for quite a while. That I'm nervous about Blip TV because I was like, how can this be sustainable? But Alan came up with a great solution for hosting files on ScaleEng, and we're combining it with an interesting DNS trick and also torrents to relieve some of the bandwidth. And it's kind of a neat combination of solutions that we've put together to solve this problem. And Alan, this is, I think, specifically something a lot of content creators out there are going to need solutions for.
So the first thing was dealing with that big burst of traffic when episodes first come out.
Yeah.
And that's basically what our CDN is meant to do. Although it typically does it with smaller files, like 100 kilobytes or even, you know, audio files are okay with like 30 megabytes. But when you start talking about 700 megabyte video files, it starts to become quite a bit to handle.
Yeah.
And so the way the CDN works is we have edge nodes. Those are the ones that you actually connect to when you download a file. And we have those spread all over the globe. But they don't actually have any files when they start out. And then sometimes we have a middle layer, and then we have our origin server. And that's where Chris uploads the episode of TechSnap when he's done editing it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the first time someone goes to download an episode of TechSnap, the edge server they connect to will go back to our origin server and copy the TechSnap to itself and send it to you. It does this at the same time, so you don't have to wait any extra time or anything. But basically, it streams it from the origin and saves a copy so that when the second user comes and asks for, you know, last week's episode of TechSnap, it's already on the hard drive locally, and it can serve it even faster.
Right, right.
And that works quite well. However, there's only so much hard drive space on these edge servers, right?
Yeah, that's like a premium storage.
Right, and we don't build, you know, giant ZFS arrays for every one of these edge servers because they don't really need it.
Right.
So eventually we have to delete the file, you know, like a two-month-old episode of TechSnap to make room for this week's episode of TechSnap.
Right. But we can't, the main barrier is you don't want to change the URL of the file download. So if you have to delete it off the edge server, what do you do to not change the URL structure? Because that could break a lot of things.
When we delete the file off the edge server, it'll be okay because if somebody asks for the file, it'll go back to the
it goes and changes again. Oh, nice. Okay. But
if that keeps happening with a bunch of old episodes, it basically means that old episode is going to use twice as much bandwidth to be delivered. Because it's going to be expired off the edge server, so it's going to always have to go back to the origin.
Right, right. That makes sense.
And so it ends up using twice as much bandwidth and burning up the space on the edge server because that file won't be purged again while it's still new.
And realistically, it's sort of solving a problem that doesn't need to be solved because an older episode of TechSnap doesn't really need to be front-loaded on the edge servers because they're not going to be as in demand.
Right. So once an episode's a couple of weeks or months old, we can switch to a more archive solution where we just have a very small number of servers that have more storage that will handle delivering the back catalog, basically.
Right, right.
But we don't want to have to go and change the download URLs all the time because that becomes a maintenance problem. And, you know, changing the URL in an RSS feed can sometimes cause it to download it a second time, even though you already have it.
And you want people to be able to spread the link around and trust that link URL will be available for as long as possible.
Exactly. And, you know, that's the whole point of a URL. It's supposed to be definitive and canonical.
Right.
So our solution, actually, was to use a DNS wildcard, which basically says, you know, any subdomain of this, in this case, subdomain, or subdomain of a subdomain of a subdomain. Anyway, points to this CNAME, which goes to our content distribution network. And then, so basically, we create a subdomain of the download URL that is the year and the month. So in this case, 2012-04 for April and 2012-05 for May. And so the episodes that come out in those months will have a URL that has that month in the URL. And then, as the episode gets old enough where it doesn't need the CDN anymore, we will change where that DNS points to point to our archive version of the CDN instead of our main distribution nodes. So when you first download the episode of TechSnap with the 2012-04 URL, that'll point to our global grid of servers. But once it's been a couple of months and that episode's not important anymore, it'll just point to a small group of archive servers, allowing you to still download the episode, but making it more economical for Chris to not have to worry about that double hit on an unpopular episode.
Right. So it's a great solution because it solves the immediate demand that podcasts have.
So the big burst, and then we also don't have to change the URL.
Right.
We just have to make, you know, one change in the DNS file once a month.
And it lets Scale Engine stay flexible about where that back catalog is stored, because you can just update that wildcard. Wherever that CNAME points to can be wherever you need it to. So if you have to move them, you can. And that's a really cool solution, because when you deal with a back catalog, the one thing it does is it just grows every single day. We just add more videos. We add two videos for every episode, the mobile version and the HD version, and we add them every day. And so it just gets bigger and bigger.
You have one show every day of the week, almost.
Yeah, and so you got to stick it somewhere eventually, and so having that flexibility is really nice. And separating it out into the month will also make it more manageable, too.
Yeah.
So that's really cool.
And so, this will also work, you know, eventually when that archive grows, if it gets to a certain point where it's like, you know, one server can only have so many hard drives, we can say all the episodes from 2011 are on this archive server, and all the episodes from 2012 are on this archive server.
Right.
And we can keep, and it gives us that flexibility.
Yeah. Yeah. It's great too. The performance has been really good. And it's better than Blip TV. And it's nice for me.
We don't actually cap the transfer rate like Blip did.
Right. And I've been able to reduce it to just HD and mobile now, because you know I used to have three versions, HD, yep, large, and mobile, because Blip would do the secondary encoding for those two, for the mobile and large formats. But now I can do the, I mean, it's a trade. I have to do the encoding, but at the same time, I can
be. And we talked about a solution for that. We haven't got around to building it yet.
Right.
But we can
But you know, I don't really, I mean, like right now, I'm just kind of using that to kind of experiment. Like, so what I've done is I've made a file that's 432p, not 720p. And not 360p, but it's 432p, so that way it still plays on iPods, and it plays on tablets. And it, so it's the mobile version now has been able to sort of take the place of both the large and the mobile, so it saves us a file. So being able to kind of control the encoding has also been sort of a boon, and I'm able to use a better codec than what Blip TV used as well.
And also the most fun part for everybody is now that the file names have a consistent naming, so that...
Oh, yeah.
Because Blip.tv used to randomly rename the files slightly.
Yeah, yeah.
And give us really weird file names that wouldn't sort properly.
And then our OCD viewers would write us in from time to time and be like, guys, I can't believe I have to ask you this, but could you name your files better? Because they are not sorting properly in my directory. And it's like, we understand. That bugs us too. It drives us crazy. In fact, my internal file structure here, I have them all named properly. I'm not having any of that. But now we have control over that.
Somebody in the chat room specifically commented, it's like, oh, look, the files are named properly now. Yay.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's because those are Chris's original file names.
Yeah.
It was
just...
Blip.tv that was renaming them when it transcoded them.
Yeah, so that's all gone now. And now I don't know how long this will last. We're gonna monitor costs and bandwidth usage and things like that. But right now we're posting nearly all the shows in an HTML5 video now on the website. So that looks really nice. And so I've been getting generally good feedback. I always get a little bit of negative feedback when I switch over to HTML5, but I'm trying to watch it. We're using a really well-respected HTML5 player that I actually spend money on because they really focus on compatibility across all desktop and mobile platforms. So hopefully it works for everybody. But that's still, you know, something we're kind of working on a little bit and kind of watching. And if you know, just a reminder, we actually covered this in the Jupiter Signal. If you want to get this month's edition, you just missed last month's, but you actually, if you subscribe, there's a way to go check the back catalog. You can get that just by going over to bit.ly/JupiterSignal. That is our monthly newsletter. All right, Al, now you've got some...
It's full of all kinds of good information.
Including
the other thing we wanted to mention was to try to alleviate Chris's problem of having to pay for the bandwidth for you to download these episodes.
Oh, right.
We set up the torrent setup.
Yeah.
And so there's an RSS feed now of .torrent files. Now, the typical problem we've had with using torrents in the past is that once an episode's a little bit old, there's no seeds left, and it makes it impossible to download the episode.
Yeah, everybody moves on.
Yeah. And, you know, that's a typical problem with BitTorrent.
Or the reverse side is you're like one of the first couple of people on it, and so nobody's seeded it. Yeah, that happens sometimes too.
And it was actually a problem for us to figure out how we would cause these original seeds to happen. And then it's like, I remember from back when BitTorrent was first invented, what the actual purpose of BitTorrent was. It was actually to solve this exact problem.
Right.
It's like, we have a website, and a lot of people are trying to download this big file. I think in their example, it's actually a linux.iso file.
Yeah, sure. It's a perfect example.
And, you know, the web server only has so much bandwidth. And so the idea with BitTorrent was that you would actually have an HTTP URL as part of the torrent. And then, so you would start downloading with HTTP to get the file from a web server, like you would normally do in a regular download.
Yeah, and the torrent
would be
client.
Other people that were downloading the file as well, and you would start sharing pieces you had that they didn't and so on to actually speed up the download.
Just to make that clear, though, the torrent client does the HTTP download. So the user downloads the torrent file, and if the torrent client sees there's no other peers that can satisfy what it needs, it will initiate an HTTP download from the CDN, and you'll get it as fast as you possibly can that way. And then once you've got the file, you'll start seeding it. You become a seeder. And then transversely, if you have like part of the file, but you're missing another part of the file because BitTorrent downloads in chunks, it can actually grab a specific chunk from the CDN.
Yes.
Which is awesome.
Our CDN does range requests, which we can say, you know, I want this byte range to this byte range in the file. So basically, yes, your torrent client will connect to the torrent like a normal torrent, except for there's a built-in HTTP seed called a web seed that will have a copy of the file. So when the torrent first starts and there are no seeders, everybody's just downloading from the website like a normal user.
Mm-hmm.
But then as the swarm grows, you'll get pieces of the file constantly from a lot of other people and only fall back to the web server when it's needed so that it's not running up Chris's bill.
Right. That's a cool way to do it, too. And so I appreciate everybody who uses the BitTorrent client. And like Alan mentioned, we've made an RSS feed available for both TechSnap and Last. You just subscribe to that BitTorrent RSS feed for each show, and then like in Miro or uTorrent or Transmit, whatever your favorite BitTorrent client is, it'll automatically pull it down when I post a new one. So that's usually like Thursday evenings. Your BitTorrent client will just fire off, and it downloads the HD version of the show. Now, Alan, you've got some toys there, don't you? You want to show us your drive cage?
We were just talking a little bit about before the show that I'm in the middle of building a bunch of new servers.
Yeah.
And I started the first server we bought, if you remember way back, was that ZFS server, and it's 2 U's tall, and it had slots for 8 hard drives for hot swappable, and then 2 fixed hard drives, which you use for the OS.
Right.
So we bought a second one similar to that, not quite identical, but from looking at it, you couldn't tell the difference.
Mm.
And in that one, we're not actually using the hot swap bays yet. We were just, we needed the extra server for something else, and we figured we might as well buy a chassis that has the ability to take 8 more hard drives in the future.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Put the 2 fixed drives in, but the chassis also came with an option where you pull out the mini CD-ROM that it comes with and the front USB port header, and it had this 5 3/4 inch slot that fit in.
Nice.
That held an SSD. And so we put an SSD in it as well.
Yeah, okay, perfect.
And that worked quite well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other 3 servers we bought after that are only 1 U tall. So right, a U is 1.75 inches. So it's about this tall. It's the whole server. It's basically the height of a pizza box.
They're awesome.
The general shape of a pizza box as well. But so it's only half as tall. So it only has 4 hot swap bays across the front, and there's basically no room for anything else.
Right.
So in these servers, we're building them actually as database servers. So we actually have a pair of Intel 520 SSDs, right? Which are very high-speed, fancy SSDs.
Yeah.
And so I ordered all the parts, and it took a while to come because the cases are kind of special order because your regular local computer store is not going to stock these fancy server parts.
Right.
And there are also a lot of different models, and they never know which one's going to sell, so they don't really stock them. Anyway, all the stuff shows up, and I start building the server, and I get it mostly together, and I run into a problem. I had made the assumption, because I wasn't thinking properly, that when I bought the SSDs are 2.5 inch instead of 3.5 inch. But not a big deal. It comes with an adapter, right? I've used that when I've installed these SSDs in a bunch of other servers.
Right.
In regular fixed hard drive slots. The difference is this thing only has the 4 hot swap slots. The difference between a regular slot and a hot swap slot is that you don't connect cables to a hot swap hard drive.
Right.
There's a backplane. And basically, this is a hot swap drive enclosure.
Right. Okay.
And this little arm helps you pull it out. And so basically, you take out this plastic placeholder and you screw in a hard drive. And then, so the back of the hard drive sits here, and you push it back into the backplane. And they're basically the headers for the power and the SATA, or SAS or whatever, and they just click into the drive.
Mm-hmm.
And then now it's connected.
Mm-hmm. It's very handy.
It allows you to actually add and remove hard drives while the machine's on, and the OS picks them up and everything. And it works great. The issue is, with your regular adapter for an SSD, which is what I have, this metal plate I have installed in this identical
So it fits in the tray there?
Yeah, so the SSD screws in with these holes here.
Right.
The issue is, it puts the SSD in the center.
Yeah, right.
Which is normally fine, because you just connect the cables.
Right, but you're not connecting cables.
So the ports are all aligned to the right, so they're about where my finger is.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
but on the hard drive, when it's centered, they're going to be about here.
Right.
So they don't line up.
That's not going to work.
Connect.
No.
I was like, oh, crap.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that totally seems like a situation I'd find myself in, to be honest.
And I was just like, how did I not think of that? I should have known better.
Right. Well, it's a simple thing, you think.
I go shopping around, and I managed to find the right hot swap tray.
Oh, okay.
So this one, it comes pre-set up, and basically, it's got the little metal things here that actually hold the SSD in.
Like little brackets or whatever.
Yeah, and align it to the right and make the power and SATA connectors line up.
There you go.
So this little $15 part saved me a lot of trouble. A lot of expensive SSDs wouldn't have got installed properly if it wasn't for this $15 part.
Well, that's good that you found that, because
I was just lucky that the computer store happened to have a couple in stock.
It was at your local store?
Well, it's not really a local store, but there's not that much. So there's not very many places that carry this stuff at all.
No.
Most of it's special order.
No, definitely. So
basically, they just happened to have exactly as many as I needed. I needed six. And they only had six.
Oh, dude, lucky.
I ordered on a Sunday, and then when I came back on Monday and checked the website to, because I was going to call and ask them, it's like, I ordered this shipped express. I kind of need it like right away because these servers are supposed to be done already.
Right.
And then I ran into this problem. And I checked the stock, and all of a sudden, there's not six anymore. There's only four left.
Uh-oh.
And I'm like, well, I ordered six, but I could live with just having four of them right now and having the other two come later on. I call up and like, no, we already set your six aside for you. I'm like,
oh good. Good. Nice.
And they got shipped and I got them the next day. And I was just like, wow, that
was some good service.
Averted the disaster. Yes.
Nice.
Well, I paid for the express shipping.
Mm. Yeah. Well, there you go. All right, I think that's everything the feedback.
When I talked to my sales guy, you know, I had been talking to him back and forth a number of times, and it's like, yeah, we just spent a lot of money. You know, we bought four whole servers with, you know, a pair of quad-core processors each, and in total we bought like 192 gigs of RAM. Right.
Oh yeah, so yeah, you're on the good
list. Six SSDs and all kinds of stuff. So.
I see, you're on the good list for sure. Know,
they kind of made sure that my parts got shipped right away.
Right. Well, there you go. That's the feedback. If you want to send your questions or a war story, you can email us, techsnap@jupiterbroadcasting.com. With all that done, Alan, I believe it's time for the TechSnap Roundup. And welcome to the TechSnap Roundup. Yeah, that's what that crazy music means. Now, the Roundup for stories didn't quite make it into the top of the show, but we still want to tell you about them. Maybe we even wanted you to follow up on them a little bit on your own, so we'll put links in the show notes. And they're almost always powered by our Reddit, including our Hall of Shame and several of our stories today. And you can get to our Reddit by going to links.techsnap.tv. Alan, are you ready for the first story in the TechSnap Roundup?
Yep.
It's our Hall of Shame submission from you remember RuggedCon? We talked about them last week on the show.
Yep. They were one of the big news items.
Yeah, they were installing that backdoor and equipment, and they had, like, when you logged in, like, the MAC address would just come right up on the screen and tell you, like, the version information of the system. Well, the TechSnap Reddit has voted, and they say we should submit RuggedCon to the Hall of Shame for installing backdoors into critical infrastructure equipment.
That use all numeric passwords that are only a maximum of 8 characters long.
Yeah.
On top of the fact that you can calculate what that 8 character password is by dividing the MAC address by 999927.
RuggedCon fail. Yeah. All right, Alan. Well, so there you go. There's another submission, and we keep on tracking these because we just like to keep a little running list of the people who go afoul, because at some level they should be held responsible for it, and it shouldn't just fade away forever. Yeah. All right. Should we cover the first story in the roundup?
Yep.
All right. Microsoft backs away from CISPA support, citing privacy concerns. Mm-hmm. So this is interesting because Microsoft, along with a lot of other tech companies, like 220, right, were on the CISPA supporters list. But
I think that was more to do with that fact that CISPA was better than the three other proposals. But, you know, CISPA's changed quite a bit since those companies signed up. And it's
gotten worse.
Better and worse at the same time.
Worse, mostly. I mean, really.
Well, they've clarified some things in attempts to appease people, but yeah, they're just making it worse.
And they did put a provision in there for protecting the children, which is always good. As a father, I'm always want to make sure that my government's protecting my children. So it's good to see Microsoft do this. They're sort of the big name. Mozilla has also come out against CISPA. And,
a lot more harshly, and they were never behind it.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So interesting stances to be taking. I would like to see companies like Facebook and other companies that hold a lot of information about us. Like, I'd love to see some ISPs. Oh, man. I would love to see Comcast come out against this or Verizon, one of the other big telcos. I would love to see that. That would really be impressive.
It would.
All right, Alan, should we move on to the next story?
Sure. There's a news report from Softpedia here citing some market research saying that, you know, this hard drive shortage was kind of fake. Seagate and Western Digital both posted decent profits. Now, Seagate's profits were quite a bit higher, and that was because they actually managed to produce 2% more hard drives than before the shortage. But if you remember correctly, Seagate's factory was not actually damaged. Their problem was just supply chain.
Right.
They couldn't get the little motors for the drives because that factory, which is owned by a different company, had the problem. So they managed to source those parts somewhere else, and keep making hard drives. Plus, they make a bunch of other types of hard drives.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
mm-hmm.
Western Digital had problems. You know, they managed to make a small profit. It's like 62 cents a share or something. But Seagate made enough money that they're actually buying back $2 billion worth of their shares so that they control more of their own company.
Hmm. Well, and I know a lot of them sold more SSDs, too, the ones that are in the SSD business. And there's probably...
Intel made did out quite well there.
Yeah, I bet.
The shortage actually hurt them a little bit as well because it lowered sales of CPUs.
Mm, yeah. Yeah, Microsoft cited that in the underperformance of Windows, too, is they cited the hard drive shortage.
And, you know, it wasn't completely fake, but yes, like, there was no reason for the prices to ever get that high. And the article also cites about, you know, never seen drives actually be out of stock. And part of that was mostly because of the rationing that went on.
Yeah.
So,
like, sites like Newegg would only let you buy, like, two at a time.
Right, or even one at a time, depending on the model.
Hmm.
But that was partly because Newegg suppliers would only give them so many at a time.
Right.
Or even, you know, for the smaller shops even, the distributors like Ingram Micro and so on, they would, each different distributor would get their share of the portion of the drives that got manufactured from the suppliers, and then they would put limits on how many each reseller could buy, and then they would, those guys would have to limit what they could sell to their customers. But the shortage was got kind of bad in the more enterprisey drives. Trying to get SAS drives, some of those prices are still way up there.
Yeah, well, SAS drives have always been really expensive.
Right, but they were, you know, there's some of them haven't come back down yet.
Right, right. They're like rack space storage prices. It's crazy. It's crazy.
Well, with the lower volume on the enterprise drives, you know, if the store bought them at the high price, thinking that, you know, because of the shortage, they might actually get to sell them pretty good.
Yeah, yeah. Now they want that money back. They want to earn that money.
it hurt them to sell them for less than they paid for them.
Let's talk about the Pirate Bay, Alan, because it's been blocked in the UK. According to BBC News here, file sharing site Pirate Bay must be blocked by UK internet service providers. The High Court has ruled. Now, I don't really... I don't have a lot of comments on this story just yet. Sites like the Pirate Bay destroy jobs in the UK and undermine investment in new British artists, the British photographic industry said. So this is kind of interesting because they're mandating being done at the ISP level, which would be sort of something that I think would be met with a lot of criticisms here in the United States. They go on also to talk about how the process has been underway for quite a while, and that the ISPs had also already been asked to do this voluntarily, but said that they would not do this unless they were requested to do it by a court order, which has now happened. As a responsible ISP, Virgin Media complies with court orders addressed to the company, but strongly believes that changing consumer behavior to tackle the copyright infringement also needs to have compelling legal alternatives, such as our agreement with Spotify to give customers access to great content at the right price. So I think they're trying to say there that what Virgin Media is attempting to say is, well, you know, yeah, we can block the Pirate Bay, but they're going to find ways around that, and education is more of an overall answer. Now, all right, Alan. Now, so that's that. So there you go. UK viewers have submitted that one. That was the top story this week over on the TechSnap subreddit. So we're there with you guys, and I know that you guys are already working on your workarounds. All right, Alan. Well, are you ready
specifically
for
specifically because of those workarounds? The Pirate Bay saw more traffic this week than it ever has before.
Yeah, that's right. Like a huge jump, actually. Yeah.
And part of that is, you know, it's kind of being attributed to the effect that even if you didn't know what the Pirate Bay was or didn't use it very often,
right?
A lot of people went to the site just to see if their ISP was blocking it. Or to see, it's like, oh right, I can go there and see what they have today.
Just goes to show you, all publicity is good publicity. It always has been. All right, well, let's talk about a major vulnerability found in the Tor browser. You know, so there's the Tor network, and then they have this integrated bundle where it's Tor and Firefox combined. And I guess on their blog, they've announced that there's a major vulnerability. You know much about this?
A little bit. So basically, it's WebSockets, which is a fairly new technology. It basically allows JavaScript to make connections to things and allow a more robust system. Now, when you're using the Tor browsing bundle, you're actually connecting to a SOX proxy server on your machine that's then routing all the traffic through Tor. The issue is with Firefox, when you use WebSockets, the WebSockets... they connect over the SOX proxy, but when they do the DNS lookup of the host name to then connect you,
yeah,
they use your local DNS instead of doing it through the SOX proxy. Normally, you don't actually look up the IP address of the site.
Oh, no.
You just tell the SOX proxy, go to this site, and it loads it for you. With the WebSockets, they don't do that. It's probably just an oversight. Nobody thought, you know, it's like, in a regular case of using a SOX proxy, it wouldn't make that big of a difference. The only case it matters is when you're using Tor and trying to stay private.
This this vulnerability was announced on May 2nd. So if you're a heavy Tor user, you know, check out the link in the show notes
on how to disable WebSockets, because they're really not used very much yet.
Yeah, so check that out.
The basic idea here is what you could do is you could say, you know, when you go to the website, you set like a session cookie or whatever, some unique identifier for the visitor.
Right.
If you then make a WebSocket connection to something like that unique identifier.user.mywebsite.com, it'll have to look that up. If you're running a DNS server that logs all requests, then you can match up that unique identifier to a real IP address, because they're going to, their DNS lookup is going to happen from their local machine, not through the Tor proxy. So it basically would be a way to get at the real IP of a user connecting to their website through Tor. And that's why it's considered a big deal by the Tor people.
Yeah, I would think so. All right, Alan. Well, the next story on the roundup is also sort of about identifying, only it's a little different take. Can an IP address be considered an identity? Well, and a judge has ruled that it doesn't. And, of course, this is a major blow to a lot of pirating cases that have been brought either by the RIAA or the MPAA.
And how many times, you know, we've seen oodles of times that these have been, you know, people that didn't do anything wrong. Wi-Fi or,
right,
you know, the fact that IP addresses gets assigned to different users all the time and so on.
Right, right. Well, what I liked is it felt like the judge actually took it another step forward. Not only ruling that IP addresses couldn't be identifiable to a person, but that also it is the recommendation of the judge that these BitTorrent lawsuits are a waste of judicial resources for a variety of reasons, and recommends that judges reject similar cases in the future. Yeah. Wow, that's awesome!
That's
I mean,
legal precedents.
Both of them.
A related one in EU, I think it was this week, they ruled that it's not possible to copyright an API or a programming language.
Yeah,
which is almost preemptively preventing the Oracle versus Google case that's going on in the States.
Which is interesting because Oracle's trying to say that APIs are like the most crucial thing that they do, and there's nothing more stressful than building an API, and they must be protected. Feather in the chat room has pointed out that Germany has already done that as far as ruled that the IP address is not identifiable.
Well, because an IP address isn't locked to a person. It's not enough information to identify someone.
Right. Right. All right, Al. Well, tell me about SSL Pulse, because that's the next story on our roundup.
Right. So it's kind of based on similar work to the EFF's SSL Observatory, except for instead of looking for bad certificate issuers and so on, this one's looking for at the server configuration for all the sites that run SSL.
Right. Okay. Oh, boy.
And so basically, they've been scanning websites and checking and basically rating them on a letter grade scale.
They're making a list and they're checking it twice, is what you're saying?
Well, basically, they check the settings and see how secure the settings actually are.
Right.
And they found that only 10% of the websites running SSL are configured to be properly secure.
Only 10% of the sites
that have SSL. So that probably means a bunch of ones that you go to don't have their SSL configured as well as it could be. Now, part of that is, you know, the defaults aren't always great, and also, you know, the default is to support a lot of backwards compatibility, right? You want the, if you're running an online store, you want it to work for everybody, not only people with a newer browser and things like that.
Right, right.
At the same time, how many, you know, if this opens up to a man in the middle attack or the beast SSL attack or so on, then, you know, that could be an issue.
What do you think, Alan? Is Scale Engine part of the 10%?
Yep, we get an A.
Do you? Good man. All right. Well, let's talk about, speaking of Comcast and how I'd like them to take some stances, let's talk about that, because word came out today from Sony that they're putting their IPTV plans on hold because of Comcast type caps on bandwidth. Alan, you guys deal with bandwidth caps in Canada, right?
Yes.
And I know a lot of people in the U.S. do as well, and Australia is a...
You know, people argue with those, and that there's problems and so forth. But in particular, Sony's complaint is the same as Netflix was when we talked about it about 2 weeks ago, is that Comcast has a competing service to their to Sony's IPTV called Xfinity or something like that.
Yep.
And if you use the Comcast service, it doesn't count against your bandwidth cap.
Right.
And we talked about how, you know, partly that's legitimate in that Comcast, it costs them less to deliver bits from inside their own network than it does to deliver the bits to from some other network.
Right.
At the same time, though, net neutrality says you can't, this is the whole point of net neutrality, is that Comcast can't bundle their service and then basically prohibit the Sony service by having a bandwidth cap.
The only gotcha, which if, this is just from my rough memory, is you remember Google took a ton of heat because they worked with Verizon to make an addendum to that that said for wired networks, if it's a closed, if it's a closed, not part of the public network, you can apply any type of traffic shaping or apply traffic shaping you want.
The exemption was for wireless.
No. See, that was a separate deal. The wireless things, that there was a separate exemption for wireless, but in the wired one, there was something put in there that said if it's not considered part of the public internet, but still goes over the copper infrastructure, you can apply different rules to it. Because what Comcast defense is we're not running that on a public IP space. We're running that on a local IP space that's just between our servers and the cable boxes.
Mm-hmm.
But it's crap.
Well, the real problem here is that Comcast owns content now. They're not just an ISP. They're part of NBC Universal. And yeah, that merger should never have been allowed.
Sony Network Entertainment's VP, GM Michael Argon, I believe, told a Variety Entertainment that he basically said this about Comcast's policy of capping bandwidth. These guys have the pipe and the bandwidth. If they start capping things, it gets difficult and it's just not a business they can get into.
Well, not just that, but Comcast basically controls 20 or 25% of all internet users in the U.S.
Right, right, yeah.
So, basically, you know, it's hard to compete with that.
All right, Alan, you want to tell me why I shouldn't be all freaked out about cyber war? Because according to my government, it is like missiles that are dropping on us every single day.
Yeah, but basically, there's an article here from CIO.com talking about how a lot of the hype and so on we're seeing with cyber warfare is mostly just the defense industry being like, all right, you know, the war in Iraq is pretty much over and Afghanistan's ending. So, you know, where are we going to get money from now on?
And I totally called it. I mean, I'm just saying, I have been calling this for a month now, and it's vindicating to see more people saying this.
That the government was trying to get additional rights, and that's what CISPA is. But at the same time, the defense contractors are trying to get their chunk of the pie as well.
It's a serious problem because the defense industry is a huge, huge part of the American economy and is responsible for a ton of money generation. And what do you do with them as you start to scale that down? The economy literally needs that machine, that engine, so they've got to turn somewhere. And you know, in some ways, going digital, at least people aren't dying. I mean, it's not a good thing, but
yeah,
it's I noticed about a month ago that the things were lining up with 2013 budget plannings and trying to get budget approvals and all that, and that definitely seems to have played a part in this.
When we were talking about the FBI's operations and keep rehyping things like they're taking down botnets and so on.
Right, right. Yeah. All right. Well, one last story in the roundup, how black markets work. What's this about?
So it's just a little investigative piece that went through, you know, some of these online black markets and how you actually would use them and how they work.
Interesting. So if people are interested in black markets, there you go. Alan's got a link for you. I agree with the chat room. I would prefer that they would just stop spending so much money on the defense budget and leave the internet alone.
It's like, you know, we kind of saw that the trend coming when a couple of years ago, some of the big defense contractors like Northrop Grumman started looking at, you know, how they were building network protection systems. So on top of, you know, the government targeting the government, they were targeting other corporations saying, let us run your cyber defense for you.
It definitely feels, though, like it's ramped up since we've started TechSnap.
Yes.
Like, it's been, like, as we've watched this and we've seen it, there's been more and more every week and a lot of repeats, so it's definitely ramped up. But we'll see where it goes. I don't know.
But part of it is, you know, the same things happening over and over again. Like, the Sony hack was people not upgrading their things. Or the Samsung IPTV, smart TVs is bad design, right? They didn't consider any type of security when they were designing these TVs.
Right.
It's like, yes, you want usability, but you have to make it so that I can't just hack somebody's TV and ruin it.
Right. I want to remind everyone that TechSnap will not be live on our regular time on Thursdays next week. We will be at Wednesday at 1 p.m. Alan's going to the BSD convention and on Thursday. So we're moving our episode record day one day earlier. The release will probably still be sometime Thursday. Probably maybe a little early Thursday. I'm not sure. But so join us 1 p.m. Wednesday, 1 p.m. Pacific over at jblive.tv.
Yes. So the usual time, just one day early next week. Yeah. And then we'll be back to normal after that.
Yeah. Alan, I think that's our whole show. I think we've come to the end.
Yep.
Yeah. All right, everyone. Well, thanks so much for tuning into this week's episode of TechSnap, and we'll see you right back here next week.